Great. Well, welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are one of more than two dozen around the world, and we are dedicated to spread broadcasting the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the latter part of the 19th century. There's literally thousands of pages that were written by the founders. So we have plenty of material to work with. So in order to spread broadcast the teachings of this lodge, we have two meetings a week, Sunday morning from 11 to 12, and Wednesday evening from 7:30 to 8:30. Now, before the Wednesday meeting, the doors open at 5:15. We have a reference library, which there's always a reference for the part. We're studying the Key to Theosophy in this winter session. And so there's a reference that goes along with the part if you care to study. There's a librarian there. There's there's a library, it's a reference library, there's a philosophical and scientific, and there's the various books there that you can peruse. And you can always ask the librarian for assistance. So all of our efforts here are voluntary contributions of time, money, and service. Anyone you see doing any activities, they're volunteers. We're all students. We're trying to put forth the teachings to the best of our ability, and that is it. We don't have any celebrity speakers. We don't advertise. We don't charge for this. For this ancient wisdom, because it is really your birthright. And so all of our, at the book table, we have books and pamphlets for sale at cost. There's no profit to be made. And the book table is open before and after the meetings. So this month, before we begin the part, and today is during the month of January, the overall umbrella topic is the path of spiritual evolution. Today we will be discussing the two paths of spiritual development. There'll be two short talks followed by a discussion, questions, answers, comments. We would like to read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And this is, as explained, we have no bylaws. We're not really an organization. We're an association of students. But this is our guiding document, as it were. The Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all.
Okay. So, we have, we're looking at this month, as was stated, the path of spiritual evolution. And today's talk is the two paths of spiritual development. What we decided to do was, in this part of the class, we're going to be looking at the heart and the eye doctrines. And we will, at the end, we'll kind of segue that into the second talk, which will be on renunciation and liberation. And initially, that kind of sounds like we're looking at four different paths. But what we're going to do in this part of the talk is just kind of look, when we're looking at the idea of spiritual development, the heart and the eye doctrine is, they are a way of development, so that when we get to the higher aspects, which will be gone over in the second talk, we'll see how indeed it is two paths of spiritual development. And all life is dual. We're looking at two paths, two doctrines. Now, HPB states, spirit and mind have to be in perfect union and harmony. Break or damage the centripetal motion of the earthly soul tending towards the center which attracts it. Arrest its progress by clogging it with a heavier weight of matter than it can bear, and the harmony of the whole will be destroyed. So the whole idea then, the goal, so to speak, of the eye and the heart doctrines are to merge mind and soul. To pull, for the heart doctrine, to pull up the eye doctrine so that the two of them will be as one. We talk about, to give an example, when we speak of the higher and lower mind, there's only one mind. There's only one hand. There's a front and a back. So as with the mind, there's a higher aspect and a lower aspect. So when we're looking at the eye and the heart doctrine, there's one doctrine, but we're looking at the higher aspect of it and the lower. So just a little explanation of what these two are. There are two schools of Buddhist doctrines. The heart doctrine is, we're looking at esoteric teachings. It's about ethics. It's about morality. The embodiment of divine wisdom, the wisdom that is permanent and everlasting. And it is symbolized by Buddhist heart. And these doctrines are what we say are for the elect, for those that are you know, very well on their way, on their path. And the eye doctrine is the exoteric teachings, which people have to learn initially, and then as they move along in their development, then they get the esoteric ideas. And it's the embodiment of the external and the non-existing. And this is symbolized by Buddha's head or his brain. And these teachings are for the crowd. Just like when Jesus was teaching his disciples, he said that he taught in parables to the masses, but to his disciples, he spoke in, you know, the teachings themselves. And one thing we do want to point out, there's a difference between ignorance and the I doctrine. With the I doctrine, people do have an idea of the knowledge of this wisdom, but it's all in the mind. There's no heart. There's no empathy to go along with it. Whereas someone who is ignorant just doesn't know. And we just wanted to point out that somebody who's ignorant really doesn't know anything about the teachings and can't be held responsible for if they don't know it. Whereas with the I doctrine, people have started on their way, but they're still looking at it from their head. So what's this process then of elevating the I doctrine to the heart? B.P. Wadia states, in the heart, the inner wisdom of the soul, the silent thinker and watcher, springs up spontaneously. So we'd like to point out that life is an inner journey. And in order for this path to be upwards, going from the I to the heart doctrine, the heart needs to be cleansed. And we know that in the Voice of the Silence, it talks about the mirror and dusting it off. And this is basically the same thing. The heart has to be cleansed. We have to try and put aside our addiction, so to speak, to our senses, and know that the senses are false. And just being aware of that helps to make it easier for us to try and pull ourselves away from what our senses are trying to tell us. And overcoming the limitations of material attractions, which is, we know, we speak of that a lot in class, because it is such an overwhelming burden that we all carry, is that there's so much pulling us from our inner work, so that, you know, there's so much out there with technology and politics and, you know, health issues. It's just, it can be very overwhelming to many people. So if we are searching for this merging of the I and the heart, we have to let the higher in. And what it is that the higher wants us to progress, but it's all the external trappings that are preventing those teachings from coming through. And if we are aware that this is what we have to do, is to try and divest ourselves from these trappings, from the external, and knowing that we are all gods in the making, then by meditation, by reading, you know, we have so many good books at the book table, we have the meditation books, that we can start on that road to help elevate the I to the heart. So we do this by self-examination, which in many respects can be a scary thing. Can we face ourselves? Now, the Bhagavad Gita and the Voice of the Silence both speak about, and both of those books are incredible for helping us along the path of raising the lower to the higher. And they both speak of having the senses under control and having patience, perseverance, and above all, accepting our karma, knowing that what is coming to us in regards to our duty, whether it's health issues, financial issues, jobs, or whatnot, whatever comes to us is of our making. And by knowing that and doing our duty, this will also help us along our path. And they both talk about the Bhagavad Gita and the voice, avoiding ignorance, illusion, deceptions of the world. And one thing they spoke of was praise. Trying not to take praise too personally, because it talks about self-deception, self-delusion, and it all leads to separateness. You know, I am better than you. And the main thing that, and it was spoken of in the reading of the Declaration, is universal brotherhood, and how it is a living, ever-present fact in all of nature, not just of the human kingdom, but the lower kingdoms as well. And the voice of the silence speaks of sow kindly acts and thou shalt reap their fruition. Inaction in a deed of mercy becomes an action in a deadly sin. And the energy of all of our hearts binds us together. And this is another idea when we're looking at this concept of universal brotherhood. And we always like to say that even though the philosophy of theosophy has no dogma, one of the main things that we do put forth as something that really needs to be followed is this idea of universal brotherhood, because we are all one, we're all part of that deific essence. And if the path that we're going to be talking about today seems too hard, too far to try and get a grasp on, we read in the literature that all that is asked of is an effort. If we fail, try again. That is all that is asked of us, is to keep trying, because nothing is ever lost. No effort is forgotten. It hangs out in the astral. And what we do in this life, we will experience in a future life. So even if we try and fail, we should just pick ourselves up and keep trying. And the voice, we just want to end with the voice of the silence, a reading from the two paths. False learning is rejected by the wise and scattered to the winds by the good law. Its wheel revolves for all, the humble and the proud. The doctrine of the eye is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect. The first repeat in pride, behold, I know. The last, they who in humbleness have garnered, lo, confess, thus have I heard.
So now we're going to talk a little about liberation versus renunciation. We must learn to discriminate between the real and the unreal, mind and matter, be-ness and being, soul and sense. Selflessness is, altruism and selflessness is what the philosophy of theosophy is about. But as stated earlier, we need to learn the philosophy first. There's often the outer is called the shell, but the shell is a vehicle. It's necessary. Renunciation is bursting through the shell. And most world religions, East and West, unfortunately, emphasize personal salvation, attainment of salvation, attainment of heaven, attainment of nirvana as the goal. Whereas renunciation, the ultimate sacrifice is to renounce and stay behind and work with our with suffering humanity, with orphan humanity. The term orphan is used because, in a sense, we're parentless. We're spiritual beings in evolution. We really don't know our lineage, in a sense. We've been cut off, because in the beginning of evolution, in this period of evolution, there were the divine initiates and instructors that were on the scenes. They really were gods. And we are too, really, which is, but we're nascent. We have the spark of divinity. We haven't had it in full flower, whereas the initiates were in full flower. And they gave forth all the arts and the sciences and theosophy. This is not only an ancient philosophy, but it's timeless. So we have these ideas, the seeds of these ideas embedded within us, but through free will and choice and making, you know, with falling in love with matter, in a sense, like Narcissus falling in love with the reflection in the pool, we've gone astray. So periodically, great teachers come to remind us of our nature, who we are, and where we came from. So this, in the East, moksha, or liberation, it's a blissful state of unalloyed joy. And if we're on one of these two paths, and we're making choices all along, in a sense, we can think we're on the path of liberation in our mind, but really we're not, perhaps. So there's choices that are made all along. There does come a time when there's an actual choice, but pretty much it's already made from all the past little choices that we've made over many, many lives. But liberation can be taken. It's to be liberated, one must be good. One must be to do all their duties, to eliminate all their karma, any negativity whatsoever. And one might not really be able to tell the difference between one who is on the path of liberation and one who is on the path of renunciation. But it's in the heart. That's where it is. It's that higher, it's that Buddhic nature. That's mind is dual. And so Buddha is the highest spiritual soul that we have access to. So when on the path of liberation, one is still spiritually has a spiritual selfishness. And that may come to, that may sound strange, but it's because the intent really is for one's own personal, private salvation. So the path of liberation is one which is stressed again and again, and the voice of the silence, which is basically where everything we're talking about today is really going into detail in the Bhagavad Gita, but even more especially in the voice of the silence, which is a devotional book. So path of liberation is the path of the renouncer. It's also called the path of woe, because by renouncing our bliss and staying behind, we're constantly working, and we're reincarnating more often too, because the typical after-death states of Devakan, the place of the gods, is where we get to experience, you know, bliss, but it's temporary. But if we give that up, we're literally going from life to life with very little time in between, because we've made a vow to ourself and to our higher self, which is ourself, that we want to work for humanity. We see through, you know, we see through the illusions and of matter, and know that that's not where it's at. That doesn't hold the power and potency that one looks for in the path of liberation. One wants to spread the love, to spread the joy, and we get to experience that too. There's maybe more heartache and pain, but a lot of that is because it seems like there's just a lot of people who just don't get it, and that can be. But we can't judge. We're told time and time again, we cannot judge. We don't know when. I mean, that person could be on the verge of a total revelation, a total renewal of their spiritual self, and maybe they seem, maybe they don't seem that way, but that's okay. just wanted to touch on some other points. Oh yeah, cities. It's in the Voice of the Silence. It says, "Gain cities for thy future birth." Now, cities. It's spelled SIDDH. IS. They are literally attributes of perfection. They are phenomenal powers. Now, these phenomenal powers, one would say magical powers in a sense, but there is a science, there's an occult science behind magic. These cities are literally attributes of perfection, and there's higher and lower cities. But to learn how to use these requires real knowledge. And it is more than merely deliverance of the mind from the thraldom, deliverance of the mind from thraldom by the sensation of sin and faults. So the sensation, the cessation, not sense, well, I guess sins are sensational too at times. But we... the cessation of sin and faults. That is the first step. And both paths, renunciation and liberation, that is really a necessary thing to do. So we follow the wheel of duty to race and kin, to friend and foe, and close thy mind to pleasures as to pain. So in exhausting the law of karmic retribution, one step that's maybe not so much emphasized or neglected is that we shouldn't get too overjoyed at what we do, or we shouldn't get too cast down by any of our actions. Just set up better causes. Another thing is, one of the other gifts of the cities in occultism is literally it teaches us how to turn the forces of evil to good. And although we may not consciously desire evil and suffering must be met and conquered in order for us to transform. We can't just run away and hide. We have to face up. So soul wisdom, we need, it talks in the, that's very poetical. The voice of silence is very poetical. And it says that we need the breezes of soul, the gentle breezes of soul wisdom to blow away the dust of our illusions. Now, this dust of our illusions are the magnetic attractions that we have of our appetites. And if one's mind is subservient to one's senses and the senses to the appetites, we get caught in that wheel from life to life until we finally say enough, in a sense, enough. So we have to really be the opposite of that. We have to watch our desires. We have to literally come out, like Jesus said, come ye out and be ye separate. We need to break out of the Maya, the prison of Maya that we have established for ourselves, and soar beyond illusions. So we just want to close with reading a quote. Sweet are the fruits of rest and liberation for the sake of self. But sweeter still, the fruits of long and bitter duty, renunciation for the sake of others, of suffering fellow men. If we have fruit, if we've been given the fruit through this work, and we have realized the fruit, are we going to hold it and consume it ourselves? Are we going to give the fruit away, give the seeds away to others for humanity's salvation? And we say salvation in the term, the root of it is salve. And a salve is a healing and soothing treatment for wounded orphan humanity. So at this time, your questions and comments are welcomed.
Question is for the first speaker, and it has to do with the head and the eye doctrine, with what we were talking about was exoteric and esoteric. So our question is, exoteric teachings, I guess, as Jesus said, he'll teach the masses in parables. So an exoteric teaching must have a lesson in it that is of spiritual value. And perhaps the classic example of that would be the prodigal son. Our question is, can we compare and contrast the difference between a bona fide exoteric teaching that has spiritual value versus a dogmatic teaching that may not be as valuable? How would one distinguish if one goes, hears certain lectures between is it true or is it not?
We think what the questioner is asking is specifically in regards to the exoteric teachings. How can one tell the difference between one that is true and one that is false?
Right, as opposed to a dogmatic teaching,
We think in regards to a dogmatic teaching would be one that the people are being told, well, this is something you have to believe. Dogmatic being that method of telling somebody that they have to do something. So this would be something that they would have to believe. And we also want to point out that in regards to teachings, how to differentiate teachings that are true and not true, we think that if it's a universal idea, that does not carve out anybody. That does not, that is for all. That is true for all time and all situations would be considered a true teaching as opposed to a false teaching. But we think a dogmatic teaching would be one that is being taught in such a way that it is something that you have to believe and that you can't question.
That's good. That's good.
Yes.
So you're speaking in terms of, like, for instance, Christianity. This is only one life, and we should get all that we can. Or that there is a person or someone who can die for our sins, that we can atone ourselves at death and be free from all the wrongs that we have done. You know, there's many more, but which sort of tells us that we're not responsible,
mm-hmm.
that someone else is responsible. So that seems to me it's a dogmatic teaching that we ourselves have to discriminate against and decide for ourselves. Is that logical? Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
And the only way we can find that out is by finding out what the truth is and basing our thoughts on that.
Yeah, it comes down to we are, you know, we tend to look at authorities. If somebody says something in an authoritative way and they have a certain position, they have a certain air about them, they can attract people magnetically to their so-called teachings, no matter how dangerous they are. Of course, we've seen that again and again throughout history. So we need to learn how to think for ourselves. And if the Christians would really read the Bible and really think for themselves, there's many references in there to reincarnation. Jesus didn't say a lot of the things. Or they're taken out of context. You know, he didn't really say, follow me. He said, these are the teachings. You know, test, check, and verify these teachings. And it goes into the personality versus individuality, which... in Theosophy, we stress a lot that we are, you know, we are personalities, but we are our individual higher self, which is sexless and it's bodiless and it's really pure. That part of us incarnates from life to life, but. It's unfortunate. There's a lot of dogma. There's a lot of dogma in the world, and so we're trying to help people. Reading the philosophy is it's a way of peeling off the layers and looking to the kernel, the root teachings. And then either accept or reject them on yourselves. We're not. There's no dogma here because you don't have to accept anything. The only thing really that the only real requirement to call yourself a theosophist is to believe that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, that all is connected. It's a fact.
And we just want to add just one thing, one short thing, is that if it was stated about check, test, and verify, Theosophy encourages that. And we would suggest that if somebody is told, this is what you have to believe, that is something that should be questioned. In the back?
Well, even the statement about we have to believe in universal brotherhood, there's really a different way, perhaps, that the theosophist might frame that, in that this is not a blind belief, an obedient belief, but rather this philosophy is an amalgam of religion and science and philosophy, where there is you come to a place of reasoned faith, where working in your own life, both in the lower mind and by the light of the higher, the acceptance of universal brotherhood as a fact in nature is not a blind belief, but it's something that has been played on the heartstrings of the individual soul and found to be true.
Yeah, well, this we said in order to call oneself a theosophist, not to attend meetings, certainly, but if one doesn't come to that, there are many things that have been, there's many movements that have kind of said, well, they came from theosophy and they didn't. And so that's what we meant. But of course, you don't have to believe anything, but really, how could you be a theosophist if you don't believe in that? So that's all.
Yeah, so much is hinging on the word belief. It almost seems like belief is a bad word. But the truth of the matter is belief is where you start. But what you do is you believe something, then you formulate that belief into an hypothesis, which can be checked. And after checking and testing, if you can verify it, it's no longer a belief. It becomes a fact. So it's not belief. Belief is where you start. That's never to be maligned. That is a good place to start. Belief. I believe this. Now prove it.
So, yeah, we follow our attractions. So it sounds reasonable and logical, or maybe it sounds illogical and we don't believe it, but then there's so many paradoxes in life that we do come to believe it. But yeah, the word believe and beliefs are so tied with organized religion that it's almost like they've co-opted those terms. But it's just like we use the term discrimination here a lot. We don't mean discriminating against. We mean just using our powers to discriminate between fact and fiction. That's what we mean by discrimination. So there's a lot of words that are kind of loaded words that have been hijacked by, you know, they've been hijacked. We want them back. So
the English language really is tough with philosophy.
Just one other thing, propaganda. Up until the Second World War, before that, propaganda meant to propagate, meant to put forth ideas. Like we propagate fruits, we propagate our crops. But now it's a loaded word. It's really, in essence, it isn't. Propagation is spreading, broadcast. It doesn't mean propagating hateful things, although that can also be done. Everything is dual.
Right. Did you have your hand up in the back?
We were going to ask about discrimination, and it was
okay.
When it comes to believing, it occurs to us that, gee whiz, it's so easy to believe. And for those who really either don't care about this kind of stuff because they're occupied with other things in life, they could fall into this rut of believing and kind of just turn over their spiritual development, so to speak, to somebody else and think along whatever line they're taught to think. So, and I mean, that's where they are. That's where, you know, you can't say the person's wrong or right because, you know, different conditions. But we're told by HPB that really theosophy is not for everybody. It's not for those who aren't willing to do the work to use their discrimination between right and wrong. But that doesn't mean that if people don't do the work, that doesn't mean that they're not, you know, building some real problems and karma for themselves. So that's why we exist, to keep these ideas in the public forum for those who might see it and wake up when they do.
Well, that was in our talk. We spoke about the difference between somebody who is practicing the I doctrine and that person who would be considered as being ignorant. And ignorant has a bad connotation to it, but in this case, it's just somebody who is not aware of the philosophy. And we know that, and we forgot our line of thought. Okay. I'm going.
It's I'm supposed to know it?
No, we
Go ahead, it'll come to you. Go ahead, in the back.
It'll come. We know from experience. We were just thinking when you're saying this, you know, each one within themselves, like, we know when something is balanced or in harmony, and we know when it's not. We also know that as far as other people are concerned, each one is on their own path of development, of evolution. So the idea is not so much to worry about what others think within themselves, is how do we really think within ourselves? Mm-hmm. Is it a yay or a nay? We are the judge within.
I remember. I did remember what it was, but it goes along with what was just being said, is that we know, as was said, what is right and what is wrong. And we all have the seeds in us of this spiritual nature. We all have it, whether we are ignorant, whether we're working on the eye or the heart doctrine, we have that seed. We are all gods in the making. And it's just a matter of awareness of that we are all part of the, you know, we have that spark, that seed of the divine in us. And to clear away the dust from that mirror so that that seed can sprout, that the higher nature can water and feed that seed in the lower nature so that it can sprout and grow. And then we get to the point where we make that choice whether we're going to be to liberation or renunciation. So, but as was said, you know, we have to be aware in ourselves truly if something is true or false.
So we don't, one of the things that the philosophy emphasizes really is we don't need a mediator. We don't need a middleman or a manufacturer's representative of some material being who created us and gave us a new soul each time, and it's of temporary duration, but then when we're resurrected, we get our bodies back. Who wants them? I mean, really, they're pretty decrepit at that point. We do not need any sort of spiritual mediation. We don't need an agent. We don't need, you know, but then it isn't witchcraft that's the problem, it's priestcraft. It's really priestcraft it's insinuated itself in there, and it's for the gullible in a sense. But I mean, good people, and again, there's no, that might sound judgmental, so we're sorry if it did. But we'll just leave it at that. It's not, you know, the way the church is, the way that the teachers are on the scene, when they leave the scene, those who are following the teachings, they make, the religions just automatically spring up. And over time, there's a lot of accretions and a lot of new innovations. And we think that often that it's not good. It's not good because theosophy is not for the mentally lazy or obtuse. You really need to think and question everything. Question it, because really blind belief is the worst thing you can do.
So there's belief and then there's extreme disbelief, right? So like ultimately what you're saying is that we need to do the work in order to attune our intuition to see what's truth versus false. But there's like also the constant sabotage that one may have of like, okay, who holds the entire truth? Like, is that, can that, you know? So I guess through intuition and by doing the work, then you can really have a better, be more capable of discriminating between.
Yeah, the whole idea with intuition is a fascinating study, because intuition is part of one of the soul powers, and we have to learn to trust our intuition. And people will say, well, how do I know that it's my intuition and not just something that I am wishing for, that I'm hoping will happen? Well, it's one of those things you have to test. You have to test it and see if indeed it is your intuition or not. And by helping to develop that will enable a person to determine if indeed what they're being told is true or not. So intuition is a good way to do that.
Yes.
This idea of the head and the heart doctrine. Now, we hear that someone who develops the intellect sometimes becomes very cold and unyielding through reason, and that if the heart quality is not developed along with it, it leads into darkness. But we find a lot of people that we may call ignorant, but they're filled with love. They're, you know, women who have children are compassionate and loving, and there's a part of their nature that has opened up. Now, is this heart doctrine an avenue to this eye doctrine? Or do you have to go to the eye doctrine first and then develop the heart doctrine?
We think that specifically in regards to the woman who isn't aware of these ideas but have this heart, the philosophy would say that one can be a theosophist and not know anything about theosophy. It is their motive. It is their heart. That if they're in regards to universal brotherhood, if they love everyone, then a person can be a theosophist and not know anything about the philosophy. But in regards to which came first, the eye doctrine or the heart doctrine, it's all individual. A person can learn about the philosophy, and their motive, their personality is such that they just kind of jump into the ethics and the morality piece of it. But it is important to still know and still learn the knowledge and the wisdom. And if a person latches on to the knowledge but doesn't have the heart, as was said, I mean, that can go into a negative way, because that knowledge is going to stay with them. They're not going to put it out and try and spread, broadcast it to others.
Well, as stated in our declaration, the true theosophist belongs to each and all. So that's the key. You can be very loving in your family, in your community, among those who you feel comfortable with. There are many fraternal organizations. They may do a lot of good, but the tendency is always, seems for the most part, to focus on like a group and an identity, and we are this and you are that, you are the other. So that's the sin of separateness. It may seem which is the greatest sin of all. It may seem like you're doing wonderful things, but if you really do not belong to each and all, then that's what you should be striving for if you want to be on the path of renunciation for the greater good of all, not just for me. Yes.
Yes.
So as I go through my week and remember this lesson and propagate it for others,
okay.
I would tend to coordinate the I doctrine with the path of liberation, with people who have been exposed to a limited basis to higher esoteric thought and maybe have internalized a lot of dogma. And I would tend to correlate the heart doctrine with path of renunciation,
mm-hmm.
that the truly enlightened and expansive soul chooses to stay back on the wheel, chooses to stay back many lifetimes and enter the well of suffering and know that they're going to suffer, but with a joy, a higher joy, that isn't attached to a specific outcome, but there's joy in being and knowing. The same way we were taught in catechism that Jesus descended into hell. And I always have pictured him emancipating the souls, you know, delivering the word to the thirsty ears of the souls there, and never being contaminated or changing himself, but just generating this love, going.
No, we think that they comparing and contrasting. Oh, okay. Well, it was basically
a
comment, basically.
Not a question. Comment.
It was.
Make it a question.
No. The comparing and contrasting the heart doctrine with renunciation, with giving up, you know, eternity, eternal bliss, so to speak, is one way to open up one's heart. And comparing the I doctrine with liberation, which is more of a self, what?
The other way around. Was it? Oh, the heart is with renunciation?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And where were we? Okay. And then the I doctrine we just lost it again. Associated with liberation. Thank you. And it is a good, you know, compare and contrasting the four things together. And that was, it was a very good way to put it.
We just thought the difference between an occupation and a profession. An occupation is something, or a job, is something someone does to achieve an end, for a goal, whatever it be. And there are many people that are not, you know, too happy in their jobs. But when you're talking about a profession, it's something that you want to profess. It's something you want to expand on, and you want to spread the joy. So we've come to the close of the hour here. Did you want to close it?
Sure. So we just test, check, and verify everything that you hear and, you know, let your intuition work to determine the true from the false. And we want to thank everybody, and our meeting is over.
And don't take our word for it.
Thank you.
Sure, thanks.